This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The film Spotlight took top honors at the Oscars this year. The movie traced the work of the Boston Globe's reporting team who uncovered the Catholic clergy sex scandal. It wasn't the first silver screen effort to track the world of reporters and journalists. Today on Movies on the Radio, we're going to take a look at your picks for journalism film favorites. Joining me, as they do each month, are Laura Boies and Marcia Gordon. Laura, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Welcome back, Laura.
Thank you, Frank.
And Marcia Gordon, who is a film professor at North Carolina State. Hi, Marcia.
Hello, Frank.
A lot of journalism films, it turns out. Who knew? I mean, I was a little surprised at the total number. I mean, there's a lot of films about reporters, journalism.
Absolutely. I think it's because we still have this idea that journalists are unique in their objectivity and integrity, at least print journalists are. So they are often a character that stands in for, you know, the honesty of honest inquiry. Yeah.
We're not unique. You know, there are saints also.
or it's the other way. They're corrupt and morally questionable. But I think, you know, there's a practical reason for it if you go back in film history, which is that, you know, when sound came to the movies in the late 1920s, there was a raid on Broadway to bring people who had been writing for the stage because they needed good dialogue. And then there were a lot of journalists who ended up getting recruited to come to Hollywood because they could write. And so I think a lot of those people kind of wrote what they knew and wrote their world into these screenplays.
And it's a great frame. I mean, they make as good a detective as a detective, right? They've got access and motive and reasons for asking questions, so it's a good frame for a film. Well, let's talk about Spotlight first. Was it a surprise to you that it took Best Film?
I think it definitely was a surprise. I mean, there was no indication that any film other than Mad Max Fury Road or The Revenant was going to win any Oscars. And then it sort of popped out as a big surprise at the end.
But, you know, it was a film that so many people saw. It's a well-made film, you know, it tells an important story. And it falls in that tradition of the journalist as kind of courageous, heroic,
high-minded.
Yeah, fulfilling an important role in society. And, you know, maybe we need films about that right now.
Boston Globe's inquiry into the clergy sex scandal.
We got law. This is it.
No, this is law covering for one priest. There's another 90 out there.
Yeah, and we'll print that story when we get it, but we got to go with this now.
No, I'm not going to rush the story, Mike.
We don't have a choice, Robbie. If we don't rush to print, somebody else is going to find these letters and butcher this story. Joe Quimby from the Herald was at the freaking courthouse.
Mike.
What? Why are we hesitating? Barron told us to get law. This is law.
Barron told us to get the system. We need the full scope. That's the only thing that will put an end to this.
Then let's take it up to Ben. Let him decide.
We'll take it to Ben when I say it's time.
It's time, Robbie. It's time. They knew, and they let it happen. Two kids. Okay? It could have been you. It could have been me. It could have been any of us. We gotta nail these scumbags. We gotta show people that nobody can get away with this. Not a priest or a cardinal or a freaking pope.
We go, a clip from this year's Oscar winner, The Spotlight, which got us thinking about journalists in the movies. Laura, tell us about your pick, an older film called Five Star Final.
This is a film that deals with the whole tabloid world that, of course, is still very strong. I mean, in the news even this week, we're talking about some scandal that the National Enquirer is trying to whip up over national politics. But this deals with an era in which people still had shame about doing bad things, and that ruining someone's reputation is really almost a greater violence than doing murder.
All right.
Oh, Murphy. Yeah? Yeah, loving this killing, huh? How many dead? Wife shot them both. Then committed suicide. Marvelous. Sure, it's a great story. Sure, give her the works. Plaster it all over the front page. Get an extra out if you want to. Say, paint it on the front of the building. Tattoo it on Hinchcliffe's chest. I don't care what you do with him, because I'm not working here anymore. No, Hinchcliffe's got to get himself a new head butcher. I've had 10 years of filth and blood. I'm splashed with it, drenched with it. I've had all I can stand, plenty of it. Take your this killing to Hinchcliffe with my compliments and tell him to shove it up his...
I didn't hear what he said. The window broke. Just
obviously a pre-code film in which you could still almost say some rather racy dialogue.
Yeah.
But this is Edward G. Robinson right after he played the gangster Little Caesar and instead playing a newspaper editor with a conscience, constantly washing his hands in his little washroom because he was forced to cover so many filthy stories.
And Warner Brothers in the 1930s was known for making social problem films and trying to do stuff about some social justice issues in a way that, you know, the other major studios were not doing. And so I think it's interesting that they're taking a lot of their stories from the headlines, but then that this is also tackling journalistic ethics and questioning, you know, kind of a corrupt media landscape. And
as always, go ahead.
There's another film made at the same time called Picture Snatcher with Jimmy Cagney, in which he plays someone who takes photographs of a scandalous nature. And that was based on a true event where photographers snuck a camera into an execution and filmed a murderess at the moment of her death in the electric chair.
Well, and as you both have hinted, and I think as you have suggested, this is also a time when people realize the press is not just an objective observer, but in some ways a player. And how the press plays the game is going to have an impact on the outcome. And so people were interested in sort of ethics, journalistic ethics, and how it played.
Right, and how reporting could actually change lives in really negative ways and have direct, I mean, that's what Five Star Final is about, ultimately, is that the press can ruin people.
Well, we listen to listeners, as always, and here is one listener who told us about his favorite.
I'm Bill Price from Durham, North Carolina, and my submission for this show today is It Happened One Night, a 1930s film with Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert. This film opens with the poor little rich girl, Claudette Colbert, arguing with her father. She's engaged to a man she does not like, and she begins the film by leaping off her father's yacht into the water in a beautiful LeMay dress, and the story starts from there. She meets Clark Gable, who's a down-on-his-luck, destitute reporter, and they take an immediate dislike to each other, hit the road together due to circumstances, and the story takes off from there.
Excuse me, lady, but that upon which you sit is mine.
I beg your pardon.
Now listen, I put up a stiff fight for that seat. So if it's just the same to you, scram.
Driver, are these seats reserved?
No, first come, first served.
Thank you.
Hey, driver, these seats accommodate two people, don't they?
Well, maybe they do and maybe they don't.
Thank you. Move over. This is a maybe they do.
That's a clip from It Happened One Night.
Well, as you can hear from that clip, this is a screwball comedy romance film, first and foremost. And it just so happens that the Gable character is a journalist who's just been fired and who is ending up trying to use this story of the runaway daughter, heiress, to kind of propel himself back into kind of media credibility. And but in some ways, that's very ancillary to this being a tale of kind of class-crossed romance during the Depression and, you know, the kind of romance that comes out of it.
Well, and it also touches on newspaper ethics the way Roman Holiday does, in which Gregory Peck has to decide if he's going to print this juicy story. It's the same thing, It Happened One Night, and exploit for his own gain this really great reportage and then decide not to out of respect for the subject.
And well, Philadelphia story plays in similar territory.
It's very appealing.
Yeah.
Well, another pick from that era is His Girl Friday. Let's listen.
Well, hello, Hilde.
Hello, Walter.
Hi, Hilde.
Oh, hello, Louie. How's the big slot machine king?
Oh, I ain't doing that no more. I'm retired. You know what I mean?
Say, Walter.
I'm busy, Duffy.
Oh, hello, Hilde.
Hello, Duffy.
Listen, Walter.
Get going.
Listen.
I'm busy.
I thought you ought to know that the governor didn't sign that reprieve.
What?
And tomorrow morning, Earl Williams dies and makes a sucker out of us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what are you going to do?
Get the governor on the phone.
I can't.
Why not?
Can't locate him. He's out fishing.
How many places to fish are there?
Well, at least two, the Atlantic and Pacific.
All right, that simplifies it, doesn't it?
Oh,
get
yeah.
him on the phone.
And tell him what?
Quiet, Duffy. He's thinking.
Tell him if he'll reprieve Earl Williams, we'll support him for senator.
What?
Tell him the Morning Post will be behind him hook, line, and sinker.
But you can't do
Why
that.
Why not?
Because we've been a Democratic paper for over 20 years.
All right, after we get the reprieve, we'll be Democratic again.
Oh,
go on, Duffy. Get going. Remember, the Morning Post expects every city editor
all
to do
right,
his duty.
All right, all
you too, Louie. Get out of here.
Okay, boy.
Walter, I see you're still at it.
It's the first time I ever double-crossed the governor. What can I do for you?
His Girl Friday, one of the other journalism flicks that we've picked today on the state of things.
Yeah, that's a cracking good movie. So what's interesting about this is that it's actually two former Chicago journalists, Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur, who wrote this as a play. And in the original play, it's about a male editor and a male reporter.
It's called The Front Page.
Yes, it's called The Front Page. Thank you. And so when this was made into a film in 1940, Howard Hawks did the directing. It was changed to a female reporter and a male editor. And so the whole aspect of romantic really tension and fighting and bickering and then, of course, resolution is played out within the context of this larger play about journalistic ethics. And also, you know, it's about the death penalty as well.
On the State of Things today, Laura Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art, Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. More of your picks on journalism films, on movies, on the radio. From the State of Things, from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're taking a look at your picks for journalism films on this episode of Movies on the Radio. We're talking with film experts Laura Boyes, who's film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art, and Marcia Gordon, a film professor at North Carolina State University. And our next clip comes from a listener with a little more cynical view of the profession. Let's listen.
My name's David Bellerath, and I'm calling from Durham. The journalism movies that I like tend to be old ones that really show the profession in a really cynical light. And a couple of examples that I have in mind are Ace in the Hole, which is a Billy Wilder film made in 1951 with Kirk Douglas, and The Sweet Smell of Success with Burt Lancaster. And they're both really good examples of showing the journalism profession in a very, very cynical light, in which journalists see the opportunity to tell a story and spread it to the masses as an opportunity for personal advancement and an opportunity to settle scores with other people and an opportunity to make money. And to me, that is a fairly consistent and consistently accurate view of journalism. And I think that we saw that a lot back in those days in the 40s and 50s because a lot of people who went to Hollywood to write for the movies also had careers in journalism. So there's a lot of crossover. And, you know, the common skill set is telling a good story, a good sensational story, and making some money at it.
Mr. Falco, let it be said at once, there's a man of 40 faces, not one. None too pretty, and all deceptive. You see that grin? That's the charming street urchin face. It's part of his helpless act. He throws himself upon your mercy. He's got a half dozen faces for the ladies. But the one I like, the really cute one, is the quick, dependable chap. Nothing he won't do for you in a pinch. So he says. Mr. Falco, whom I did not invite to sit at this table tonight, is a hungry press agent and fully up to all the tricks of his very slimy trade. Match me, Sidney. Not right this minute, J.J.
That is from The Sweet Smell of Success, which is one of the journalism flicks we're looking at today on The State of Things. So once again, and I think that should be pointed out, the idea that journalism is somehow a profession that does stand apart from the system is silly. It is an industry. It is part of the capitalist process. It cannot possibly report on itself because it is part of the process. And so that's, you can't really get the kind of leverage you'd like as a journalist to get outside the system and view it. I think this film is one of the many that actually sheds a light on that.
Well, The Sweet Smell of Success is about a gossip columnist based on Walter Winchell, who had a tremendous amount of power. He was very involved in denouncing people as communists, so people were really afraid of him. This movie has a gorgeous black and white look. The dialogue is amazing. Burt Lancaster calls Sidney Falco, played by Tony Curtis, a cookie full of arsenic, which is one of the greatest insults ever. But there are a couple of movies right now, Hail Caesar, the Coen brothers' new movie, and Trumbo about Dalton Trumbo, which also talk about the power of the gossip columnist and how what that person said in the newspaper could make or break a career.
And Sweet Smell of Success, I mean, it's one of the many films that kind of cast the idea of journalists, even if it's in this kind of gossip column-y way, as gangster figures that have this power and can use it in ruthless ways, and who often do.
Here's a little fact for you, speaking of the Caesar film by the Coen brothers. Antony and Cleopatra, a little thing done by Shakespeare, is a play that by far has more messengers than any other Shakespeare's play. Now, this is coming when at the end of Empire, when the Empire has finally descended, the Republic has descended into totalitarianism.
Right.
The Republic has descended, and so we're at that period now. We're at the phase now where the fall of the Roman Empire. Here we are. But it had more messengers than by far, like 2.5 times more messengers than any. And those messengers at times were lying and knew it. They were sometimes conveying a lie that they didn't realize was a lie. There were times when they thought they were telling a lie, but in fact were telling the truth. It was an amazing, you know, sort of behind the scenes look at how storytelling and image building was so much a part of this kind of taking over the Republic and this and the power machinations behind it and the power of the messenger to participate in all that.
Right, and then when the journalist has, in the case of something like Sweet Smell of Success, so much power, what's their responsibility, and ultimately who do they answer?
Well, our next pick is one that many listeners chose, and not surprisingly, let's listen.
My name is Dennis Doros, and I'm co-owner of Milestone Films. My favorite journalism movie has to be All the President's Men. I saw it in college when it first came out, and like many, many others, it led me to see journalism as an important part of society, as a very valuable means of protecting the public against corruption. And I still think that I get two newspapers a day because I still believe it's one of the most important things we have in the United States.
The story is dry. All we've got are pieces. We can't seem to figure out what the puzzle is supposed to look like. John Mitchell resigns as the head of CREEP and says that he wants to spend more time with his family. We don't exactly believe that.
No, but it's touching. Forget the myths that the media has created about the White House. The truth is, these are not very bright guys, and things got out of hand.
Hunt's come in from the cold. Supposedly he's got a lawyer with $25,000 in a brown paper bag.
They follow the money.
What do you mean? Where?
Oh, I can't tell you that.
But you could tell me that.
No, I have to do this my way. You tell me what you know, and I'll confirm. I'll keep you in the right direction if I can, but that's all. Just follow the money.
There it is, from All the President's Men, the most famous line, I suppose, from that film.
Yeah, so obviously this is a film about, for those who haven't seen it, about Watergate scandal, and which ultimately led to Nixon's resignation. And this is a film, as with Spotlight, about the journalist as hero and as playing an important social function that, you know, if nobody's watching out for what's happening behind closed doors, you know, who is going to hold politicians accountable? They're not going to do it for themselves. And so I think in the 1970s, there's a number of these journalist expose films that were really, really important and very timely. This came out just a couple years after Nixon resigned.
And of course, the 70s, in a way, was our last idealistic era where we really thought that a man who knew the truth could make a difference in the world. And All the President's Men remains an extremely inspiring film as far as two dogged reporters and their ability to take down the Nixon administration.
I wonder how many people saw this film and became journalists.
I think this is the number one inspirational movie.
I saw that film and I wanted to become an actor. Robert Redford, that guy does okay. I thought to myself, maybe I could be him. That didn't work out, and
I
am.
Not yet.
Well, you're the Robert Redford of the radio, Frank.
You know, here's the thing that has to be said about that film, though. I will have to say, and you can imagine that I'll have something just a little bit bitter and sour to say about this. Can't you imagine that? This
yes.
is the one film everybody's going to agree. It pointed out this wonderful moment
Let us
American
have
history.
It.
Well, here's the thing. Competition among newspapers and the press, that's very good. The reporters are out there scrambling to, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post trying to get it all. That's good. If it wasn't for competition among the agencies that were spying on their own people, namely the FBI and the CIA at the time, who were giving up the other side in order to protect themselves, I don't think Woodward and Bernstein would have gotten half of what they got. And I'm not sure that even a dogged reporter could have broken that story if it weren't for the fact that there was some illegal spying going on and those guys were trying to protect their own hides and therefore leaking stuff to the press.
And we're talking about the movie, not what
I know. I'm just trying to set you all straight about what was going on. And what still may be happening today. All right. Hey, La Dolce Vita. Let us take, we've been all over Italy now, Fall of the Roman Empire. Let's talk about that film, though, Marcia, because that's a film that is a foreign film that in a lot of ways I think has something to do with what we're talking about.
Yeah, well, this is a very different kind of film than we've been talking about before. On the one hand, it's very playful and it's known for its kind of glimpse at this kind of hedonistic Italian society, but it's about the emptiness of that society, but it is also about kind of paparazzi and tabloid journalism, but you know, in such a different vein than everything that we've been talking about so far.
Because Marcello Mastroianni has such a conflict about whether he wants to participate in the debauchery or he wants to observe it. And his conflict about that creates the tension in the film.
La Dolce Vita, The Sweet Life, I think.
Yes, exactly.
Let's talk about so other films now that our listeners chimed in about. Our next pick, a much less serious one, Chevy Chase in the 1985 movie Fletch.
My name is Dolly Sickles, and I'm from Apex, North Carolina. And my favorite journalism movie is Fletch with Chevy Chase. Even though it's an old one, it's one that I can watch over and over again. Everything about the character of Fletch to me is compelling. He's irritating. He's compulsive. You know, he's like a dog with a bone going after stories. And I think, like, really, if he were a colleague of mine, you know, you would just want to kill him, but you would also follow him off the edge of the cliff.
Who is it?
It's John.
John who?
It's John. John lived. And I don't remember.
John Cocktoasten.
Hi.
Hi.
I was hoping you'd say that.
I just got out of the shower.
Yeah. Can I borrow your towel for a sec? My car just hit a water buffalo. Nice place you have here.
I'm surprised to see you. What are you doing here?
I ordered some lunch.
You ordered it here?
Well, I knew this is where my mouth would be.
I really should change.
Oh, I think you should stay the same wonderful person you are today.
I mean, put clothes on.
There we go. A clip from the 1985 film Fletch.
Fletch is kind of a cult comedy. People who love it really, really love it. And over the years since it was made, there have been many efforts to reboot it as old favorites try to get repurposed anew. And Hollywood has failed to find an actor who could replicate Chevy Chase's performance, and scripts were never, you know, up to snuff. So Fletch is, for the moment, going to have to remain an old classic.
Unless they discover Frank Stacio, and that could be the beginning.
The one thing I noticed in listening to that clip and thinking back to the start of our show is they talked a lot slower in the 80s than they did in the 40s, didn't they?
They certainly did. Why is that?
I don't know. So you would think that things would have sped up. You think that people talked faster.
People talk slower and slower as time goes by. It's a proven fact.
It's proven by the movies.
No, the style. I mean, certainly the style in the 1930s and 1940s was so staccato and rapid fire and people stepping on each other's lines. And those films were so much fun to watch for that reason and really have to pay close attention. But
I think Chevy Chase was just waiting and hoping that actress would remember her lines. that might also be a pace issue.
Line. Well, okay, so we talked about that. Let's turn to now a more. See, this is a docudrama, in fact, that sort of, which is what's nice about this is that we can say, well, this might be rooted in some, like All the President's Men, in something that we really know a little bit about. And we also talked about this with Spotlight. So let's talk about this one that is based in reality and find out why this one might be so appealing.
Hi, my name is Karthi Natarajan, calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. My favorite journalism movie is The Insider. It's a phenomenal movie that really is a two-pronged movie. One is about the main character, Dr. Jeffrey Wigand, who famously known as being the whistleblower on very large tobacco company Brown & Williamson. But the journalism aspect to the movie is his connection with Al Pacino's character, Lowell Bergman, who was the longtime producer at 60 Minutes, who brought him into the spotlight to bring his voice and his knowledge of what Brown & Williamson and really Big Tobacco is doing to the American public. What's fascinating in terms of a journalistic sense about the story is the conflict between the information that Dr. Wigan provides, but also the potential conflict that the corporate lawyers at CBS had sort of unearthed that put CBS at harm, affecting a potential merger and lawsuit from Brown & Williamson because they were, at the time, interested in acquiring Westinghouse, who had owned CBS News and 60 Minutes.
Lowell, I think I decided to preface Sunday's show. I did 3 minutes on the evening news. You'll want to see it. Where are you going?
I've been banished in lieu of being fired.
I took off on Tisch. I took off on corporate. They'll know they're not going to see everything on Sunday night.
I don't know. How does that get Wigan on the air?
Do me a favor. Will you spare me? For God's sake, get in the real world. What do you think? I'm going to resign in protest to force it on the air? The answer is no. I don't plan to spend the end of my days wandering in the wilderness of national public radio. That decision I've already made.
This Sunday, Wallace will broadcast a report on the tobacco industry, including the tough tactics tobacco companies employ to keep a lid on information that might be damaging. Is there information that people should have that they're not going to have because you're not going to broadcast this interview?
Yes.
Today, CBS News President Eric Cluster defended the network's decision not to broadcast key portions of the controversial interview. Mr. Cluster said, quote, "The atmosphere is tougher than ever."
Where's the rest?
Dan?
Where the hell's the rest? You cut it! You cut the guts out of what I said!
It was a time consideration,
Mike. Bullshit! You corporate lackey! Who told you your incompetent little fingers had the requisite skills to edit me? I'm trying to band-aid a situation here, and you're too dim to...
Mike!
Try Mr. Wallace. We work in the same corporation doesn't mean we work in the same profession. What are you going to do now? You're going to finesse me? Lawyer me some more? I've been in this profession 50 years. You and the people you work for are destroying the most respected, the highest rated, the most profitable show on this network.
50 years, but he started as a game show host. I just want to point that out, just so you know. Anyway, yeah, okay, there we go. The Insider, great film.
Yeah, so, I mean, the thematic of, or the concept of the importance of having an independent media. I mean, as we have witnessed all these media conglomerate mergers and mm-hmm. corporate interests being tied into journalistic ethics, gets more and more complicated. This is a really serious social issue, right? I mean, if we don't have media reporting on things without kind of corporate influence censoring, self-censoring, basically, how are we going to get our information? Because we all know, right, based on the movies, that the journalists are the ones that uncover, as in life, these kinds of stories. So this is a film all about that.
And also it has to do with television news, which is a little bit different. And there are certainly other television news films that did not make the big list, like Network and Broadcast News,
yep.
In which the reporters are often pitted against their corporate overlords.
Yeah, and that's the same kind of story of like the individual, the underdog having to fight against the powers that be in order to get a story across to the people.
We are, by the way, in the terms of the wilderness of NPR,
yeah.
I will just tell you that more people are listening to All Things Considered in Morning Edition now than the CBS Evening News.
Is that right?
That's the fact.
That's really interesting.
There you go. So, but yes, it is a wilderness, and we do get, by the way, we get paid, and so we have foundations, so nobody doesn't get paid.
Right.
You know?
Of course.
So, but obviously having corporate interests that are selling the movies or selling records and everything else that they're kind of cross-promoting makes it very suspect, and particularly when they're selling the kind of good life that you can get by consuming more stuff,
right.
It's really hard to convince you that you're living in a world that's not providing the good stuff, and then buying more stuff won't make it even better. So they are careful about that.
And the insider deals with tobacco, which is a very fraught issue as far as television is concerned, because it makes so much money. So should we say that it's bad for you? Maybe not.
Yeah, well, and that's why they took it off the TV, and that's why tobacco is history here at the American Tobacco Historic Institute, where we do the state of things with Laura Boyce and Marcia.
Where now you get hamburgers instead of cancer steaks.
That's right. You can't smoke here. It says no smoking and no guns. You can't have either one here. We're talking about movies that have to do with journalism, and we'll do some more of that when we come back. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. It's Movies on the Radio today with Laura Boyce and Marcia Gordon. And, of course, you who called in with picks about your favorite journalism films. Here's one of them.
My name is Godfrey Herndon, and I'm from Durham, North Carolina. And my favorite movie is The Quiet American. It involves an older English journalist who has come to Vietnam to cover the French war in Southeast Asia and decides to stay because of an unhappy marriage. He makes a life for himself, including a mistress, a very beautiful Vietnamese girl. And that relationship is threatened when a quiet American, American doctor, comes in ostensibly to help children in Vietnam. But the movie concerns, is the quiet American what he seems? One of my favorite scenes is the very opening of the movie, which is very atmospheric and involves a kind of a voiceover with Michael Caine.
I can't say what made me fall in love with Vietnam. That a woman's voice can drug you. That everything is so intense. The colors, the taste, even the rain. Nothing like the filthy rain in London. They say whatever you're looking for, you will find here.
There we go. It's Movies on the Radio today. We're talking about journalism films. We see a lot of films about war correspondents.
Yes, I think that is kind of a subgenre. This was written, the novel The Quiet American was written by Graham Greene, novelist, newspaper man, possibly spy, a very interesting character. He talked a lot about espionage, both in his fiction and his nonfiction. Yes, there are lots of movies about war correspondents. Another one of our listeners mentioned that The Year of Living Dangerously. And of course, even now, Tina Fey is in Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. So yes, it is a subgenre of journalism film.
Well, our next pick comes from a public radio employee. Let's listen.
My name is Melody Kramer, and I live in Carrboro, North Carolina, and my pick for my favorite journalism movie is The Devil Wears Prada. I worked in journalism for a really long time, about a decade, and I remember seeing The Devil Wears Prada at the beginning of my journalism career. And I have to just say this straight from the bat. I've never had a bad boss. I'm really, really lucky. I've always worked for really good people. They never made me do the things that Meryl Streep made Anne Hathaway do in that movie. But I remember one scene where Anne Hathaway was asked to find the last Harry Potter book, which I don't think had been published yet or had been published in England, but not the United States. And she had to scrounge around for the copy of that book to present to her boss, Meryl Streep's children. And I did things like that, not for my boss and not for her children, but I had to find things that were really complex that made me extremely stressed under very, very tight deadlines. So I really related to the Anne Hathaway character.
I need the new Harry Potter book for the twins.
Okay, I'll go down to Barnes & Noble right now.
Did you fall down and smack your little head on the pavement?
Not that I can recall.
We have all the published Harry Potter books. Twins want to know what happens next.
You want the unpublished manuscript?
Well, we know everyone in publishing. It shouldn't be a problem, should it? And you can do anything, right? Yes, Bobsy. I know, baby. Mommy's working very hard to get it for you.
She doesn't get it. No, I can call frickin' J.K. Rowling or something. I'm not gonna get a copy of that book.
My girls are leaving on the train for the grandmother's at 4, so the book better be here no later than 3.
Of course.
And I would like my steak here in 15 minutes.
I actually didn't see that. She really named a twin Bobsy? Is that really true?
That I don't know.
That's what you called the kid. Anyway, go ahead.
But the Devil Wears Prada is based on the author of the book, her experience working at Vogue magazine for Anna Wintour, who is a notoriously strong-minded individual in the newspaper business. And I don't doubt that she was asked to do insane things.
And there was a documentary, a full frame.
Yes, called The September Issue.
Yeah, about.
But you don't see her making those kinds of extravagant demands.
No, that would be more of a behind the scenes as opposed to caught on camera situation,
exactly,
I would
suspect. Exactly right, yes.
Yeah, but again, this theme of the power of journalism, too. I mean, it's interesting, the polarity here, you know, the ability of the press to unseat power when it's corrupt and the ability of the press to be the power itself, which is the corruption itself.
Well, she has this great monologue in this film, Meryl Streep does, about how you're wearing that sad little blue sweater and you think that you made this choice yourself. But in fact, there are legions of people who chose that color. And then it was given to a certain designer to do his collection. And now it's filtered down to Casual Corner or wherever you bought that. And you think that you have made this choice when this choice has been made for you long ago.
Well, and I think even though this film obviously is not the same as some of the other more serious journalistic films that we've talked about, there is a fascination with the role of the editor and what it takes. I mean, which is always kind of ruthless and rarely do you have like the tender, you know, embrace of your editor at the desk. It's like you have serious decisions to make or you have all this power and everyone beneath you will do anything to make you happy.
Well, a 1940s version of that is one of my personal bizarre favorites, Lady in the Dark, in which Ginger Rogers plays a magazine editor who can't make up her mind and she's being badgered by the worst psychiatrist in the history of the movies. Basically to cede her female power to a male who can actually capable of making the decisions that she is stymied over.
And Laura just showed that at the North Carolina Museum of Art, and I went to that screening, and it truly was one of the most insane films I've ever seen in my life.
Why, thank you, Marcia.
You're welcome.
That means so much to me.
This next one, also a rather lighthearted pick, Morning Glory.
My name is Ashton Romer. I live in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and my pick for my favorite journalism movie is Morning Glory. I love Rachel McAdams' character. She's spunky and confident and smart, funny, comfortable in her own skin, and brings a lot of positivity and determination to her work, which is what I hope to be someday.
Look, Mr. Barnes, Jerry.
Big Break's facilities are antiquated. Uh-huh. It's understaffed, underfunded. Oh, and the pay. Mm-hmm. Awful. About half of what you made at Hey, How the Hell Are You, New Jersey. You've never been an executive producer. You're too young. Nobody's ever heard of you. And here, your education 3, not 4 years at Fairleigh Dickinson in Teaneck, also known as Fairleigh Ridiculous. Did I miss anything?
Daybreak needs what I need. Someone who believes that it can succeed. Trust me, I know you don't have any reason to believe in me, but I work harder than anyone else. I'm in first, I'm out last. I know a shitload more about the news than someone whose daddy paid them to smoke bonds and talk semiotics at Harvard. And I devote myself completely to my job. It's what I do. It's all I am. You can ask anyone.
Well, that's embarrassing.
Yeah. This is about a Today Show kind of morning show. Her co-stars in this are Diane Keaton and Harrison Ford, who really bring the comic to this film. Rachel McAdams is not my favorite actress, but this is by far her best performance. She totally brings it with her enthusiasm for rejuvenating a format that many people really don't care about anymore.
Well, I guess the other point is, I mean, you talked about this earlier, the fact that so many writers came from newsrooms once Hollywood started to have this appetite for more writers. And the fact is, you know, it's a comic setting. Anybody who's been in the newsroom knows that you have every kind of drama, every sort of theatrical possibility. There's the drama of there's the soap opera of the newsroom, but there's also the comedy. I mean, I've never been in a place where at some point somebody didn't say, this is a comedy. We should do, this is a sitcom. Our show is a sitcom.
Well, and in fact, if you look back to those classical Hollywood journalism stories, the bit characters are fantastic. So there's usually really great jokes that abound in those films that have to do with the string of secondary reporters, and even in something like The Front Page that gets turned into His Girl Friday. Some of the best characters are the neurotic, obsessive, or downbeaten reporters that also populate the newsroom.
And if you're talking about sitcoms, well, The Mary Tyler Moore Show certainly was totally about the family of the newsroom and the ridiculousness, perhaps, of the local news story, but the intense dedication that the staff brought to their jobs.
Well, we're looking at journalism films today on Movies on the Radio, and a documentary made the cut. Page One looked at the New York Times and, in particular, media critic David Carr. Let's listen to how one local newsman described it.
This is Seth Efron. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina. My pick is Page One, Inside the New York Times, a 2011 documentary that mostly featured David Carr, the late media critic and writer. He took such joy in what he did, and it was reflected so effectively in the movie, both about journalism and about the joy of reporting about what is going on. Really painted a wonderful picture of David Carr and the great work that he did.
You know, you could say, well, being at the New York Times is a big advantage. You know, it kind of scares people when you call them. And I also think I sound sort of weird on the phone, and it's like, what, do you have time to talk to me? Great. How long did you work at the Trib?
It's a big story that hasn't really been told in this kind of comprehensive way. The biggest media bankruptcy in history, billions and billions of dollars just evaporated. A lot of people lost their jobs.
It's really important to remember that the consequences of this bankruptcy did not just fall on the employees at the Tribune Company. In Los Angeles, in Chicago, in Hartford, in Baltimore, the diminution of those newspapers crippled or destroyed important community civic assets. It's gonna be a pretty rugged story, and I want it to be fair, which is why I'm calling you.
That's from Page One about media critic David Carr in the New York Times.
So this film documentary came out in 2011. I think it's interesting to even think about it just five or so years later, because it was really trying to assess the effect of the transition from print to digital. It's a lot of what it's about. And, as local newspapers go under and are struggling to figure out how to keep subscribers and to have the money to pay reporters instead of just using, syndications. I mean, it's a very timely portrait, I think, of that moment. And I think it has a very important historical value that people can look back on and go, oh, that's what was happening in 2011. And we've seen a lot of change since then in terms of digital delivery of news.
And of course, the New York Times is still the gold standard as far as investigative reporting. Regardless of the staff cuts that are shown in this film, they still seem to have enough reporters to really do the in-depth reporting that we idealistically expect of our news organizations.
Well, and talk about transitional films that had an impact on all of us. Seth Efron, who is the listener who chose that, in fact, is one of the founders or co-founders of the North Carolina Newsroom Cooperative, which is an attempt to reconstitute any kind of good documentary journalism and perhaps investigative journalism in a cooperative format. So, yeah, you've got to be able to sell whatever it is you're doing, but you don't have to please shareholders. You can actually just keep the lights on. And so the idea that we're in the process right now of reconstituting ourselves in the digital age, and somebody like Seth would like that film and also be busy doing the work.
Yeah, well, and also this, one of the things that the Times has done, as other newspapers have, is a lot more digital film video content, short pieces that you can stream on the website that are doing a different kind of reporting. It's not just the traditional print words on the page delivery, but showing us sometimes very immersively things that are happening in other places and in our own backyards.
Well, lastly, Marcia, talk about your pick.
So my pick is a fairly recent film called Citizen Four that came out in 2014, directed by Laura Poitras. And this is a documentary that's, to me, it's really about journalism at this moment, even though it is actually about Edward Snowden and the role in some ways that Poitras and Aaron Greenwald played in Snowden's, leaking of documents and then fleeing to Hong Kong. And so a lot of what the film does is allow the audience to spend some time in Snowden's world, where Poitras and Greenwald have this exclusive access to listen to him talking about why he did what he did, and in that way offer a kind of counter to the dominant media representation of him.
What's the next step? When do you think you'll go public? Or...
I think it's pretty soon. I mean, with the reaction, this escalated more quickly. I think pretty much as soon as they start trying to make this about me, which should be any day now, I'll come out just to go, hey, you know, this is not a question of somebody skulking around in the shadows. Yeah. These are public issues. These are not my issues. You know, these are everybody's issues. And I'm not afraid of you. You know, you're not going to bully me into silence like you've done to everybody else. And if nobody else is going to do it, I will. And hopefully when I'm gone, whatever you do to me, there'll be somebody else who'll do the same thing. It'll be the sort of internet principle of the Hydra. You know, you can stomp one person, but there's going to be seven more of us.
I think this is an important film for a number of reasons. This is the third film in Poitras's post 9/11 documentary trilogy, trying to really understand how America has changed post that traumatic global event, and it's really about trying to understand, you know, how information travels. It's a version of All the President's Men, you know, in terms of the story about how our government is held responsible for things that we don't know about. But this is one that affects every single person in this country and a lot of people in the world. And so I think it's showing a really key story that has not, you know, reached people in other ways.
And what do we do without the whistleblowers? Right. Because they're the canary in the coal mines who, you know, then ask the journalistic profession to help them get that message out to a wider world.
Well, and to the point, you know, Woodward and Bernstein were not chased out of the country and threatened with indictment precisely because they were working well within the system and they were taking information from the people who were actually shading the information. When you actually get the information that nobody in power wants you to have, you're running for your life if you get it out there.
Well, and it's also, and this is the case also with the filmmaker. I mean, Poitras has been detained and searched every time
Hounded.
She comes into the country. There was a long New York Times piece about it. And so this idea that, that filmmaking and reporting are kind of converging in important ways, but then also that the relative freedoms of conveying information about what our government is doing, I mean, those are things we should all be aware of and be very, you know, careful to scrutinize.
Marcia Gordon, Laura Boies, today on The State of Things. Marcia is a film professor at North Carolina State University. Laura Boies is film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. As always, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Next time, we're going to do buddy flicks. No shortage of those. So find out about that. You go to our website, stateofthings.org. That's going to have all the information for how you can be part of our next Movies on the Radio on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.